Hello and welcome to Asia Matters, the show where we go beyond the news headlines to discuss what's shaping the world's most fascinating region. I'm Andrew People.
And I'm Vincent Lee. This week, we turn our attention to China, where the annual political gathering has just wrapped up in Beijing. This year's Lianhui, as a shorthand for China's National People's Congress, as well as Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, gained much attention outside China, thanks to the introduction of a controversial national security law for Hong Kong.
That's right, the new law has caused a new flare-up in tensions between China and the US. But aside from Hong Kong, there was plenty of focus on the health of China's economy during the meetings. They were, of course, delayed from March due to the coronavirus. Premier Li Keqiang announced that for the first time in many years, Beijing has scrapped an annual growth target for the country.
Yes, indeed. We'll talk about the Chinese economy in detail in a bit. But first, let's get some takeaways from the meetings with two very fine scholars. So joining us now from England is Professor Sean Bransley, who is a professor of politics and international studies at University of Warwick, and Ding Ding Chen from Guangzhou. He is a professor in Jinan University and the founding director of a think tank called Intellasia Institute. Thanks so much both for joining us. First, let's start with your takeaways from this year's Lianhui meetings. What strikes you most from this year's meetings? Ding Ding first.
I think the most important takeaway from my perspective is the economic growth target that specifically, as you mentioned, first time for Chinese government, there was no clear growth target this year. Obviously, it has a lot to do with the COVID-19 pandemic. But also, on the other hand, it's well a result of the recent years' slowdown of the economic development. So it's wise not to, you know, mention a specific target this year because of these reasons. But I think that's very surprising for many observers, and that would lead to some maybe unintended consequences this year, maybe also in coming years.
Sean, what is your takeaway from this year's Lianhui?
I think what's happened is there's been an acceleration of a number of trends that have been emerging over the past 4 or 5 years. And rather than them evolving slowly, they've all come to a head this year because of what's happened with COVID. So things that have been on the horizon are no longer on the horizon. They're actually here now and with us. And how to cope with slowing growth, how to transit from one type of growth model to another, how to balance between deleverage and maintaining growth. And fundamentally shifting the balance of legitimacy from success defined in terms of delivering economic growth to something else. And what we've seen this year, they've all come together very quickly. So now there's no possibility of really dealing with them incrementally over a number of different years, but they need a sort of holistic solution over the next 1 or 2 years with joined up thinking. And that's where I think we are. And it's not going to be easy.
So an important focus on the economy this time. But let's turn quickly now to the topic that's really been dominating at least the international coverage of this year's Lianhui. Ding Ding, why do you think it is that Beijing has decided to make this highly controversial move now? It's introduced this new security law, which many people are warning is kind of almost the end of the one country, two systems system that's been in place for the last several years.
Well, first of all, I think I agree with Professor Bransley that there are many trends that have been already developing over the last several years. And now it seems like they all come to peak the result or the outcome this year at this particular moment. And I think Hong Kong is no exception. This law and the other measures, they were in the discussions for quite some time already. And it is a part of the overall new framework for the central government to practice the full administrative right, so to speak, over Hong Kong, 全面管制权. So it's really, in a sense, not surprising, but maybe the timing is surprising, but the timing probably can be explained by several factors, particularly this year, the new developments in Hong Kong itself, and also the relative absence of the U.S. government
right.
by pandemic factor. But remember, this is Lianhui, right? You wanted to pass a law, you have to do it here. You cannot pass a national legislation in another time or on another occasion. This is the right place, right time to do it. Maybe it's a little bit early or a little bit not too early. That's debatable, but I think the overall trend it has been very clear for the last several years. So this is really expected to some degree.
Mm. So that it was almost a timing issue. Now was the opportunity to make this move. And as you say, many Western governments, their attention is elsewhere. They're still dealing with the pandemic. Nevertheless, this move has attracted a lot of criticism. What do you think Beijing's long-term aim for Hong Kong now is? There's plenty of worry about its future as a financial hub. It's obviously been such an important financial center for many years in Asia. But what do you think Beijing's plan, long-term aim for the city is?
From my perspective, the long-term plan or the goal has been the same. That is to say, to uphold the one country, two system framework. But here, I think the new emphasis or the new difference is gradually on the first part, meaning one country, then two systems.
Right.
So usually people may get confused by thinking, okay, this means two completely different frameworks or systems or whatever. But it should be noted that there is one country in front of the two systems. So I think this, in the long run, suits the central government interests, also, of course, Hong Kong interests. And the same goes with another administration region, Macau. So I think, you know, that has not changed. And on the other hand, you know, this is only about national security. It's really about the most fundamental issues regarding national security. It's not about the day-to-day sort of administrative laws or things like that. So I think, you know, there's a difference between national security law and, you know, all other normal kind of how to govern the local economy and society. So that's still, you know, two systems. And of course, we understand the concern, the worries, but I think it's different matter when you talk about the long-term plan, and long-term goal. In my view, that has not changed. It should not change. And I think there is still, in my view, a very good prospect for one country, two systems framework in the long run. But it will take some time for both sides to come to a sort of common understanding of that. And that's currently the focus, I believe.
Right, Sean, let me turn to you on this. We've seen a lot of strong rhetoric from Western governments. You know, Donald Trump held a China-specific briefing yesterday, and he talked about mainland China as well as Hong Kong. And in London, there is strong rhetoric there. Do you think these strong rhetorics will be matched with equal amount of actions, this is first? And if so, how far both rhetorics and actions can go?
I think there will be action. And we've already seen Trump talking about getting rid of Hong Kong's status as an independent entity in terms of economics, which actually I don't think helps Hong Kong in any way. We've heard talk in the UK about extending visa rights and periods of stay in the UK and possibly citizenship. We'll have to wait and see how that plays out in the long run. But I don't really see this having a massive impact on the Chinese government, to be quite honest. And on the contrary, it sort of plays into this narrative, foreigners meddling in something that they have no right to be meddling in at all. I think from outside China, it's not easy to really understand how firmly this idea of sovereignty and also of China being defensive, trying to defend its interests in a hostile international environment are really embedded. Not just within the leadership, but within Chinese society more generally. So I think there will be action. I don't really see it fundamentally changing Chinese priorities and policy. And in some respects, it might even strengthen the arguments of sovereignty and looking out for China's interests in this hostile global environment where the United States and the West are trying to stop China from developing.
Sean, staying on that theme of how this plays domestically in China, can we talk more broadly about where you see Xi Jinping's position now? What did we learn from the Lianhui about that? I mean, obviously, recently, some have said that his position was actually weakened by the initial handling of the pandemic, and there was widespread criticism of him on Chinese social media. But others say now that China's actual relative success in recovering from the pandemic has bolstered his position. Where do you think the truth lies? And did we learn anything from the recent meetings about Xi's position in China?
I'd like to answer this, if I may, by going actually back to 2012, 2013, because every time we look at the NPC, every time there's this focus on the domestic at the Lianhui, what we see, I think, is the regime showing that it doesn't take its grip on power for granted. I think when he came to power in 2012, Xi Jinping looked at China and he saw four things that were either, if not broken, they were becoming strained. The economic model had reached its shelf life. It needed changing to something else. The party had lost all sort of cohesion and coherence and unity. The third is that the relationship between the party and the people had become stretched to breaking point, that people didn't trust the party anymore. And the fourth was that society itself was in some way broken. There was no unity. There was no common purpose. Everybody was out for themselves. And then very quickly after that, we can add a fifth in terms of the environmental crisis hit as well. And dealing with any one of these would have been a major challenge. But the only way I can understand what Xi Jinping has done is that he saw all of these as being essential to be dealt with during his tenure. And perhaps one of the reasons why his tenure is going to go on longer than normally it might have done. So what we've seen over a number of years is this effort to assert control, his control over the party and the party's control over society, and to really hammer home the importance of stability. And this brings us, I think, to the pandemic, because the same political system, the same concern with stability, the same incentives for officials, the same way in which the whole country is organized, both created the problems in the early stages, in my view, and yeah. also the ability to respond through the mobilization in the longer term. The failings and the successes actually due almost to the same structures and same systems. So as I see it, we're in the middle of this very difficult transition. Everything's come to a head. I'm going to sit very firmly on the fence because I think it's going to be a few years before we can really tell. What is clear is that the narrative has been very heavily placed on the success, not surprisingly. And this is one of the reasons, of course, why the West is being blamed for blaming China as well and not being grateful for all the wonderful things that the regime has done in, first of all, stemming the crisis at home and giving people time overseas, time in which they could have made better preparations but didn't. So at the moment, I would say that I think that it's steady as we go. But there's a lot of issues to be sorted out in the next 4 or 5 years that are going to be very difficult to maintain control in the way that it's been established over the last few years, particularly I think now with the growth of unemployment. This seems to be the real big challenge that's loomed up very quickly. So I'm sticking firmly on that fence and I'll come back and talk to you in 3 years' time.
Yeah. Yes, we'll talk about the economy in more depth later. But Ding Ding, to what extent do you think China now is very worried about the health of the economy and in particular, like Sean mentioned earlier, the rising unemployment situation in China?
Obviously, I believe the government is deeply concerned about this. After all, you know, China is a big country with a big population. Every year you have up to maybe 8 million or so college graduates who need jobs. And this year is going to be difficult to find jobs for these new graduates, not to mention the fact that some companies, they're also laying off employees. But there are two reasons I think things will be under control. First, right now, it seems like China is going to recover from the pandemic relatively quickly.
Right.
You know, generally now, factories are back to business, even though because of many factors, they're not really at a full capacity or something like that.
But there's slowly, also a concern of the second wave in China as well.
Yeah, that's also a concern. But now the whole government, the whole society is much more prepared. So it's very unlikely for even for a second wave to have the same kind of effect like January. So I think the second wave can be managed, if not completely avoided. So that's reason number one. Getting back to normal slowly. For example, my city, Guangzhou, now restaurants, in the parks, in the schools, they're all open. But internationally, it's still in the midst of the crisis. The second reason, I believe, is more about comparative perspective. Because, you know, you're not only talking about China as just one economy, you're also talking about all other economies, whether they're also doing much better or they're also struggling. And in that regard, so yes, you know, China is doing much worse than it was several years ago, but compared to others, it's still okay, in an okay shape. So this would not, you know, really fundamentally challenging the narrative of the government, because okay, we are not doing so well, but this is global. So we are, you know, trying our best to survive this, and maybe we are, you know, we will emerge a year or two later, like, you know, financial crisis in 2008. By next year, we'll definitely know much better.
Sean, I think your analysis there of what's happened in the last few years under Xi Jinping in China is very clear and accurate, that in a way he's looked to centralize power again in China to deal with some of these enormous sort of structural problems that the country faced when he came to power. The downside of that, of course, is that if you sort of take on responsibility for all these problems and power is centralized with you, you have this sort of big man problem, don't you? That if things then go wrong, it's kind of your fault and everyone also knows who to blame. Is that a concern, do you think, for Xi going forward? Yes, they've got through the pandemic, but now the economic recovery, that's somewhat uncertain still. Do you think there'll be more problems for him going forward now that he's sort of taken on sole responsibility and these sorts of issues in China aren't being left to things like the market to sort out anymore?
Yeah, I think that's always a possibility when you become the sole source of authority, or even close to the sole source of authority, as Xi has become. A lot of people were commentating at the outbreak of the pandemic that it was Li Keqiang that was put in charge rather than Xi Jinping, and then Xi Jinping emerges more clearly into the limelight when things start to go well and the pandemic becomes more under control. So these things are important. And I think what we will probably see over the next couple of years is an even stronger emphasis on the need for unity and the need for cohesion and the need to follow the central line. We've seen quite a lot of this over the last few years, but I don't think it's going to be weakened in any way, because as, if you like, the economic levers of legitimacy face a few problems, you have to search for the ones to replace them. And I think this is where the unity behind Xi comes in, the sort of propaganda ideology campaigns, and also this idea of China as a great power and a leader on the world stage comes in. But yeah, of course, it creates possibilities. If you're the person who's in charge of everything, then you, I guess, are responsible for it. At the moment, you hear all these rumours occasionally about opposition to Xi, but I don't know where it comes from, right? I'm really not sure where the coherent opposition to him comes from. And, okay, with hindsight, we can often see things that we can't see at the time. But it's very difficult at the moment to see where the real challenges to him might come from, other than from a more sort of general societal dissatisfaction with the way things are going.
And Ding Ding, what's your take on this on the ground in China? How do you feel about Xi's position within the party and within the government? What are people saying in China?
Well, I tend to look at this from a point of the trends in the last few years. Remember, President Xi came to power in the year 2012. It's been almost 8 years. And over the 8 years, nothing really has happened when it comes to his consolidation of power and position within the party. And I don't think that will change anytime soon, simply for structural reasons. You know, it's not in a way in the DNA of Chinese society or the system. There has to be some sort of opposition to be there. So it's normal. So, you know, it's not necessarily this kind of crisis or pandemic or economic slowdown would pose, you know, serious challenges to the authority and the legitimacy. So it's a different political philosophy in a sense.
Right.
It's not an automatic result of any crisis in the case of China. But of course, that can change. But I don't see any, again, agreeing with Professor Breslin, any solid evidence that this would be a different case. But, you know, economic growth is very important. And still, I think it's doing okay, but if doing really badly, that would be very difficult, of course.
Right. Now, talking about President Xi, foreign policy is his signature policy in his tenure. So, Ding Ding, let's talk about the Belt and Road Initiative, which is very much highlighted by President Xi's ambition for China in the world. Do you think this pandemic has somewhat disrupted this grand initiative?
Well, it depends on which perspective you look at the initiative. again, already we are now in the second stage of the Belt and Road Initiative. I think last year the government already announced the first 5 years was sort of a period of big brush. You paint the, you know, painting with big brush, ignoring the details. The second stage, starting from last year, would be more focused on the details, details on the ground. So the specific projects, environmental projects, green financing, how not to increase the debt burden of for countries, so on and so forth. So already since last year, I think everybody already feels that, you know, this big talk about BRI was already gone. So this year, obviously, it would be affected, but it's not because the BRI itself has been ignored or de-emphasized or anything like that. It's really because the attention now is more on domestic growth or the pandemic. And by the way, all the projects are still ongoing, you know, despite maybe some delays in some regions. So this BRI will continue in the second stage of this 5 year. But how fast it can go, I think it will definitely be influenced by the economy and the foreign policy and also the local conditions in Africa, Latin America, and everywhere, U.S., of course. So in a sense, it's been slowed down, but it's not, you know, a deliberate decision. It's more of a result of multiple factors working together.
Yeah, you talked about the United States. We know Donald Trump is not a fan of China in many regards, and he also withdrew funding from the World Health Organization. Do you think Beijing sees this as actually an opportunity for China to play a bigger role in such an important international organization? And if so, what do you think Beijing will do to organizations as such?
I think in the last few years, again, along with all other trends, China has been more active in multiple international organizations. WHO was relatively small one before because the main focus was on IMF and World Bank and maybe UN. And WHO was relatively, you know, sidelined because usually you don't get in a pandemic like this. So the overall trend is this, you know, China is getting more active in all around. Okay, not just WHO, but also other regional and international organizations. You know, Donald Trump, the recent decision to terminate its relationship with the WHO, obviously is a big mistake for the U.S. from a strategic point of view. You know, many U.S. strategic thinkers do not agree with that. Even the government, maybe itself, within the government, some people do not agree with that. It's more of a personal decision. So I think China would continue to be more active. Not necessarily in a sense of taking advantage of this opportunity, because you can imagine sometime later, maybe who knows, next year, when there possibly will be a new host in the White House, the U.S. administration would again be very, very interested in working together with allies and multinational organizations. But that doesn't mean China would stop playing a more active role. So this is an overall trend. I think you will see more and more of Chinese involvement in international organizations.
Right. Talking about big power competition between US and China, Sean, observing all this unfolding in front of you in Europe, what do you make of this relationship? Do you think this marks a fundamental shift of the US policy towards China and vice versa? And where do you think this tit-for-tat is heading?
It's very interesting looking at this from Europe, because obviously what happens has a massive impact on us, but you feel a little bit powerless at times. One thing I would like to say is that often it seems that this has been pitched as a zero-sum game. So if America loses global leadership, then China automatically gets it. And I'd be a little bit wary about that, because I think it's entirely possible to sit and look at this relationship and think that what's happening in America is, frankly, a disaster, and think that withdrawing from the World Health Organization is incredible, but at the same time not think that China is wonderful and successful as well. I mean, I think it's entirely possible to look at both of them and see problems there.
Yeah.
So while there is, I think, you know, an opportunity there for China, we shouldn't assume that it's automatically and necessarily going to take any power that America loses. And I think in some respects, this is where we are in Europe looking at this relationship. We're not abandoning America and leaping onto a new alliance with China. On the contrary, I think we're finding ourselves in a situation where we're dismayed at what's happening in the United States. And a lot of people are increasingly dismayed with what's happening in China as well. And this means that we're not heading towards, I think, an old bipolar Cold War type relationship with two camps. And if you're in one camp, by definition, you're alienated from the other camp. I think we're in a situation where people are often going to find leadership lacking, and countries are going to have to find a way between this superpower competition without necessarily firmly allying with one side or another. And we have seen a hardening, I think, of positions on China in Western Europe over the last, three, four, 5 years. And again, that's been accelerated by the pandemic. So we see elements here of a bipolarity, if you like. But it's not creating these firm block camp type relationships that we might normally associate with bipolarity. So I think we're in for a messy world, to be honest, one where there is increased tension with China from liberal democracies. There are increasing questions about a dichotomy of values. But still, China remains an important economic player, an important partner in environmental governance, and as Ding Ding's just said, playing an ever-important role in many different forms of global governance. And I think a lot of the old paradigms that we use to try and explain the future should remain old paradigms and for the past. And we need to come up with some new concepts and ways of thinking about the world as we move into a very strange situation of this elements of bipolarity, elements of multipolarity, and elements of fragmentation and elements of cooperation at the same time.
Interesting. Just very quickly, Sean, what do you think Europe can do then, being caught up in between US and China, big power rivalry?
I think the first thing that Europe can do, and this is a bit ironic coming from the United Kingdom, is behave as Europe and try and get back to talking with a single voice. Too often, I think, China has been seen as a competitive opportunity in Europe. So you've seen individual European powers almost competing with each other to develop relationships with China. And now I think the time is ripe for a common approach, if possible. We've seen in the pandemic that the unity and solidarity wasn't always there when it was needed. This is another occasion where I think it's needed, and I'd be interested to see whether Europe can act together and develop a single coherent approach.
Sean, just one last question from me too. Do you think there's a danger that China overplays its hand at this time? I think it's a really important insight that you have there, that there's a sort of vacuum of leadership in the world at the moment. But obviously we've seen China, not just the move on Hong Kong, but there's increased tensions with India at the moment.
Yeah.
It has some slightly more aggressive language on Taiwan at the Lianghui. Is there a danger that China sort of misses this moment to get more people on its side by being overly aggressive?
The answer is very definitely yes. When you look at what happened in the pandemic, initially, of course, the focus was on China and what happened in Wuhan and the spread and the lack of control there. And then China was given an opportunity, really, by the way that a number of Western countries didn't respond to the pandemic very well, the United States, United Kingdom, Italy, and so on. There was an opportunity there for China, really, to establish itself as a provider of medical supplies, which it did, as providing a model of how to deal with the crisis, which it did. But then you have this group of diplomats who take this very aggressive, defensive position on the internet and also in the Global Times and also publishing from the Chinese embassy in Paris, really using language that's going to alienate anybody who reads from the West. And so I think there was a missed opportunity there to an extent. There was an opportunity to put aside the failings of the early days, perhaps, and make some ground back. And I really don't quite understand why this aggressive nature has come across in English language outlets. Because if it was for domestic purposes to try and deflect blame, fair enough, that's understandable. But the people that are reading this are primarily people outside China. And I don't think it's given a very good impression of what China is and what China wants. In reality, it's only a handful of people, actually, two or three diplomats,
yeah,
who write for the Global Times. But I do think it's having a really sort of negative impact. Now, maybe the feeling is that you're never going to persuade the liberal West anyway. Maybe they've decided that,
yeah,
this is a battle that can't be won. But it's certainly not a way of attracting people who might otherwise have been a little bit questioning. It's really reconfirming for those who already believed it, the idea that when China can change the world, it will do, and this won't be to the West's benefit.
Dindy, what is your view on that? What does Beijing think, you know, with all these questions Sean just raised?
Well, I think probably it's debatable what the motives are, but I think without more evidence, I think it's more of a defensive nature. it should be understood maybe within the context of the recent U.S.-China relationship. Obviously, one reason, in my view, is China feels like it has been unreasonably attacked by the U.S. diplomats, including Secretary Pompeo, on many, many issues. The previous approach didn't work, right? The previous keeping the quiet voice without punching back, so to speak, really didn't work. It only got worse and worse from the U.S. side, not from the Europe side. And what do? You only have two choices, basically, right? Either you continue the old approach as if nothing has really happened. That can be effective in some cases. But obviously, I think the conclusion now is, okay, maybe let's try something else, see if this works, right? We punch back, and maybe in some cases it did work. In some cases, it didn't work. And it's debatable. You know, when Donald Trump first mentioned, you know, Wuhan virus, they punched back. Then maybe for Trump's own reasons, he stopped using that phrase. And now we are seeing more of this. But I think overall it's still defensive. It's not like they would jump out saying things to everybody. I think the main target is to the U.S.
I take what you're saying there, right? And I think it is primarily defensive. But it went further than that. You know, you had diplomats in Paris saying that French healthcare workers had abandoned their jobs and left their patients to die in the beds. I mean, that's not defensive. And this is the point I'm trying to make. There is a defensive position to be made. There is a, you know, stand up and say, no, don't call this the Wuhan virus. But then to say, but actually then we think that it came from Fort Detrick, or actually we think that it came from Italy, or actually, as the ambassador in the UK said, the world should be thanking China, not getting China to apologize. Or to say that French healthcare workers abandon their patients. That's where it goes too far. This is what I mean, that the original defensive intent then has gone on a step further. And it's that step further that I think is causing more problems than it's solving, in my view.
Thank you so much, both of you. We're going to have to end the discussion there. Absolutely fascinating situation that we're in, somewhat worrying situation we're in, of course, with these tensions, particularly between the US and China. But that was a terrific summary of the Lianhui and the big political meetings that we've seen in China and the latest moves there. Thank you, both of you, for your time today and for joining us here on Asia Matters.
Apart from domestic and foreign policies, now one other issue that's closely watched by the outside world is, of course, China's economy. Now this year, Beijing scrapped the annual GDP target due to the COVID-19 situation. And in the first quarter of this year, China's GDP shrank by 6.8%, which is the lowest in recent memory. So has this year's Lianhui given us any clue as to how Beijing will tackle the economic challenges? Let's turn to another guest, Dr. Jue Wang, who lectures on the Chinese economy in Leiden University in the Netherlands. She is also an associate fellow at Chatham House here in London. Dr. Wang, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's turn to this 6.8% or negative 6.8%. How worried do you think Beijing is about it?
I think Beijing is pretty worried. That's also why you don't really see a clear GDP growth target for the first time, probably since mid-1990s, 1994, probably. I would say it is very much because of the pandemic going on, because there are too many uncertainties in this year's growth prospect, both within China and in the external market. I have seen different kinds of prediction of China's annual GDP growth rate for this year, ranging from 1.2% to 3.6%. So it is going to be very low, no matter which one will be true by the end of the year. It is going to be very low. Therefore, there is less focus on the demand for economic acceleration. Instead, the government decided the priority of this year's economic objective is what they called six stabilities and six securities, mostly referring to securing people's basic livelihood, employment, and the main market entities, etc. So I would say yes.
Right.
It shows there is concern behind the growth prospect.
And do you think this concern has also led to Beijing's fundamental rethink about how it shapes the narrative surrounding its economy? I mean, Even before this pandemic, China has been talking about, you know, putting more emphasis on quality rather than quantity, right? So do you think, you know, this pandemic also accelerated this thinking, and in the future, we wouldn't see these figures making too much headlines?
Right. So like you said, Beijing has aimed for focusing more on quality than the quantity for some time. It is also a main part of the new normal, a term that Beijing raised a few years ago. But there has always been a clear target for annual GDP growth rate, despite the narratives around new normal. Until this year, this is the first time for a long time Beijing does not set a GDP growth target. I would say, yes, there is a trend towards focusing more on quality, but I would say it is temporary. The fact that there's no clear numerical target for the GDP growth rate.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, setting that growth rate target is somewhat odd. Not many countries do it. But in a way, in the past, it's been used by the central government in Beijing to almost control the local governments across China. It's a way of sort of saying, look, this is the target for the year. This is what we've got to hit. And when you move to more qualitative economic targets, it's a bit more difficult, isn't it, for the center to control that. So do you think that's a bit of a risk in abandoning a growth target, albeit obviously this year's growth was going to be slower anyway?
That's an excellent question. In fact, there were some discussions among Chinese economists and policy analysts about whether they should set a GDP growth rate target before the Congress meeting. Those who believe that this shows some flexibility in the government's macroeconomic policy making, because there are too many uncertainties going on, and it's not possible to set a reasonable target. And if you set a target under uncertainty, this may lead to inappropriate stimulus measures. And if you set unrealistic target, and the local governments may manipulate their data to show they have reached the target, but in fact they probably have not. But then there are also other economists that think setting a growth target is still necessary because, like you said, it is a usual tool in the central local coordinating system in Chinese political regime. And the local authorities are very much used to making economic policies in order to reach this goal, this target, this numerical. Yeah. So without this usual tool, the coordination may face many confusions. And if you look at the new targets this year, there's the six securities, which are securing employment, people's basic livelihood, main entities of market, food and energy security, stability of supply chains, and operations of local government and public mechanisms. You would see it's difficult to measure whether they actually meet the goal. How do you measure it? So this may create some ambiguity and confusion. And plus, some economists believe that in order to secure these conditions and these six securities, they very much depend on the actual economic growth. Because without an actual economic growth, how do you secure employment? How do you secure these market entities, right? So some do believe a clear target is still necessary. So we will see by the end of the day where they reach.
Yeah. I mean, you know, setting a target or not, you know, Chinese economy is not in its best shape at the moment. But back in 2008, we were also in a, you know, massive trouble in terms of Chinese economy as well as global economy. And then Beijing launched a massive fiscal and monetary stimulus for its economy. It seems this time around, China is quite reluctant to do it. Could you tell us why? What is the thinking behind it?
Right. I think that's mostly because back in 2008, most of the fund released by the central government was eventually channeled toward infrastructure sector and fixed assets with low productivity and low efficiency. So a lot of local government financing vehicles were established to help local government raising funds for infrastructure projects. And the stimulus measures contributed to massive overcapacity, especially in steel or cement, etc. And the real estate price was pushed up to really high level. And the local government also accumulated high debts. It has taken the government a really long time to control the financial risks emerged from these measures through a whole series of policy measures to remove leverage. But still, financial risks exist in the Chinese economy at the moment, and the local debt level is still very high. This is why the government is trying to avoid what happened in 2008. That's also why they still need to be prudential with the monetary policy measures this time.
Yeah, it's interesting. So they want to avoid that kind of massive buildup of debt that was the kind of legacy of their response to the 2008 crisis, because they're really still in the middle of dealing with that debt hangover at the moment. And this pandemic has come at a bad time. So given that, you know, China can't really go all out on debt again, do you think what they presented during the Lianhui is a sort of realistic package of measures to stabilize the economy right now and to get it back on the track of growth? Are they doing enough, in other words?
So what they propose this time, in addition to the monetary policies, they also announced quite a lot of fiscal side policies, right? So the government announced that they would increase deficit to GDP ratio. In particular, it would increase the fiscal deficit by 1 trillion yuan. And on top of this, there's an extra 1 trillion yuan of special bonds for the COVID recovery. And in addition, it also announced to increase local government bonds by 1.6 trillion yuan. So in order to make these fiscal side policy effective, the fund needs to reach the main market entities. And these main market entities are what the Chinese call micro, small and medium corporation consumers. And they do aim to make the policy effective by promising all these funds will be transferred to local authorities, especially at municipal and county level, and for facilitating programs for protecting people's basic livelihood and employment, as well as small and medium corporations. And these programs include reducing fees and taxes, reducing rents, strengthening investment, etc. And the target is set as reducing fees and taxes by 2.5 trillion yuan, which is enormous. And the compensations will also be provided to the local income families. So I think if they do manage to implement these policies effectively, these fiscal policies might be more effective than the monetary ones, because these financial policies target certain beneficiaries, which are small, medium corporations and consumers who are affected by the COVID recovery. But yes, it depends on whether these policies will be implemented effectively through this complicated central local coordination system.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? That's been an issue for years, really, in the Chinese economy. And under Xi Jinping, a lot of people, Nicholas Lardy, an economist who's looked at this a lot, says that, you know, there's been a retrenchment to the state sector under Xi Jinping. But obviously, this effort now to get more funding to small and medium-sized enterprises, there seems at least a desire to try and get the private sector to drive the recovery and keep employment levels high. So is that the way you see it, that maybe there's a shift more towards the private sector now? Or do you still think that SOEs and running things through the state-owned enterprises is Xi's priority?
That's an excellent question. It's also a very important topic for the Chinese economy, China's state-guided economic system. So, like I said earlier, if this policy, if the latest policy is implemented appropriately, the SMEs should be the priority beneficiaries of these specific policies of COVID recovery. And the government also in the past years has repetitively emphasize the role of private enterprises in high-tech sector as the real dynamic innovators, also these SMEs roles in services as the main employment provider, etc. However, I don't think it means that SOEs are losing their prominence in the Chinese economy, because SOEs are still seen and used as a powerful economic vehicles that lead the production and the services in several key sectors, including energy, transportation, telecommunication, AI, robotics, etc. And they're also the primary actors of China's overseas economic expansion. If you see the primary role of SOEs in those massive infrastructure investment projects in the Belt and Road Initiative, as well as in mergers and acquisitions in advanced economies. And also, what makes Chinese SOE quite special is they have certain social responsibility to fulfill. If you look at the COVID-19 crisis, during the crisis, especially during the beginning of the crisis, The Chinese government relied on the SOEs to maintain production of key equipment for the health system during the Spring Festival period when most of the private companies were closed for the festival. So I would say the SOEs are still very, very important vehicles for the Chinese economy.
Right. Part of the role of the SOE is also to maintain the employment rate in China. But
absolutely.
Despite what they are doing now, unemployment is a rising problem in China. You know, some estimate this year's unemployment rate could amount to as high as 20% or even more. Have we read anything from this year's Lianhui that the government has some other measures to tackle this mounting issue?
So from the government's work report by Premier Li Keqiang, yes, we said in the beginning, there's not a clear target for the GDP, but there are some clear target for solving unemployment. They released some numbers, for example, to create more than 9 million new urban jobs. There were also clear targets for unemployment rate. But you also notice that the increase of jobs is lower than last year, and the unemployment rate target is higher. So this shows the difficulty. This shows a rather unfortunate reality in China's unemployment at this moment. And also, I've read some domestic analysis that this year will be a big year for university and college graduates. Some reports predicted there will be between 8 and 9 million of university graduates. So employment will be challenging. This is also why the government takes the main market entities as a priority.
Chui, can we turn to China's economic position and how that plays internationally, and particularly with regard to the trade war? I mean, obviously, China's economy is going to slow this year, as are most major economies, probably all. But of course, China also made some pretty big commitments under the terms of its trade deal with the US. How is China going to be able to fulfill those commitments, things like buying some $200 billion worth of soybeans when the economy is slowing? And how's the US going to take that if they're not able to fulfill those commitments this year?
Obviously, it won't be easy. You may not see a large increase in the domestic consumption in the Chinese market. But I suppose it should be understandable that it is caused by the pandemic. And I think the Chinese authorities are also explaining repetitively it is because of the pandemic. So the domestic consumption has shrunk, but we hope there will be recovery from next year. This is also why I suppose there won't be a harsh, complete decoupling between Chinese and U.S. economy, despite all the dramas in the bilateral relationship going on as we speak. Because the U.S. economy is also partly reliant on the enormous Chinese market. It depends on how many goods the Chinese consumers can purchase from the U.S.
Right. Obviously, the economic fallout of this global pandemic, this also means a shortfall in both demand and supply side. You know, how could China manage to mitigate this problem that's also partly out of its control?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think if you look at China's position, I can probably add a little bit of optimistic point to this because China is one of the first to recover. So it has some advantage, at least to prevent supply chains or manufacturing from moving out of China. But then again, that advantage does depend on how the others recover. If the others don't recover, then China's export will be hurt big time. So while the export is hurt within the Chinese economy, we might see investment and consumption will be more important driving forces of the Chinese economy this year. But then, of course, it does not mean China will let go export. In fact, we have seen a little bit of a recovery in April, but that's mostly because of the factories in China have restarted and they need to finish some orders left from early in the year. But if the pandemic continues to hurt external market, export may not recover very well this year.
Just to tie in a little with our earlier conversation with Sean and Ding Ding about international relations, China's obviously taking a slightly more aggressive stance on the diplomatic front with Hong Kong, India, and so on. Is it not worried that it's doing that at a time when the global economy is obviously weakening, its domestic economy is weakening, isn't it a bit of a risk to make those sort of diplomatic moves, which risk some kind of blowback from the US and from other countries, maybe as going even as far as sanctions and higher tariffs? Isn't that a bit of a risk for China to be taking with its economy right now?
So we have seen that China announced they would have a tighter security grip on Hong Kong, and the US responded. President Trump very recently made an announcement, said the US will revoke Hong Kong's preferential treatment as a separate customs and travel territory from the rest of China. Some also expect the US may also implement restrictions on the export of high-tech products to Hong Kong, or they may also punish some specific Chinese financial institutes. So yes, these are all the risks. I think the Chinese authority thought about at least some of these possible measures from the US side when they were going through the new security measures for Hong Kong. So at this point, the actual impacts of the US potential sanction on Hong Kong are unclear, because even the actual sanctions are unclear. But I do think some of these measures may also hurt US interests. For example, US financial institutes operation in Hong Kong. So Beijing obviously would not want to see Hong Kong's status as a free harbor and the Asian financial center to weaken. But I don't think Beijing will withdraw or change its decisions on the new security measures for Hong Kong. But I do think the central government will provide support for Hong Kong, at least financially, if the city does face difficulties and problems due to the punitive measures from the US. Somehow they will have to do that. They will have to provide support for Hong Kong.
Joy, just one last question from me then to wrap up on the Lianhui and China's economy. I mean, some people were hoping for a little bit more out of the meetings, a little bit more of a radical approach from the government. Are you in that camp as well? Were you somewhat disappointed? Were you expecting more? Or do you think it's steady as she goes at the moment?
I think the reason we haven't seen more fundamental reforms this year from the government's work report is because of the pandemic. I think the priority this year is to recover from the pandemic. I think in a way it shows how severe the impacts of the pandemic really are. And also it is one of the shortest government work report in the recent decades. So I think it shows the government really is focusing on the COVID-19. Let's see whether next year we will see more fundamental reforms to promise a better quality of growth, or more measures in improving the social safety net, or more reforms in the service sector, etc.
Thank you so much for your insights today, Joy. Thank you for all of that. It's certainly a picture of steady as she goes at the moment, I think, stability rather than radical reform. Maybe we have to wait for that for next year, as you say. Thank you to you. Thank you to all our guests today. Thank you to Vincent, of course. Thank you to Rebecca Bailey, our producer. And of course, to Alex Lestrange, who does the music for Asia Matters. You can contact us at asiamatterspod@gmail.com on email. On Twitter, we're at asiamatterspod. We have lots more episodes in the pipeline, so please stay tuned. Thank you for listening today, and have a great week.